From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. As we take you back to 1939's The Wizard of Oz, we'll tell you about what's happening with new films this week. Our critics review the animated Scoob. It's directed by Tony Cervone and brings back the characters from Scooby-Doo. Capone takes us to the final year in the life of the gangster Al Capone. Tom Hardy stars in the biopic. The 70s set comedy drama Mother's Little Helpers stars Melanie Hutzel and is written and directed by the co-star of the film, Kestrin Pantera. And we'll also hear about the socially conscious horror film Body Cam, starring the singer Mary J. Blige, all coming up on Film Week. Welcome to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC and the Film Week app. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us as we talk about the new movies that are out on streaming services and video on demand with this week's critics, who are Wade Major of Cinegods.com, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day, and Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. Speaking of animation, we begin with Scoob. Scooby-Doo and the gang are back. The film directed by Tony Cervone. The film is written by Matt Lieberman, Adam Stiekel, and Jack Donaldson, Derek Elliott, also the credited screenwriters. Charles, what did you think of Scoob?
Well, this is one of those crazy quilt films that are stitched together out of pieces of other things. And you sit there and think, okay, that's Big Hero 6. That's Iron Giant. That looks like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2. That's this. I mean, for a lot of Gen Xers, Scooby-Doo is really an iconic show. It's got all those wonderful, you know, childhood memories. But I don't understand why, if you want to do a remake of it, you don't do a remake of it. Scooby-Doo was always about the gang solving mysteries, or more properly, mystery, because it was always, you mean Mr. Mantle, the bank president, was really the Phantom all along? Yoikes! And in this case, they're on this enormous adventure. They're trying to stop Dick Dastardly from Wacky Races, from releasing Cerberus, the evil dog of, you know, the underworld, and stealing treasure. And it's not what you watch Scooby-Doo for. And another part of the problem is, in recent years, we've had two other characters who are a lot like Shaggy, who with Scooby, you know, was the main focus, who are much better animated and better written. And that was Fred the Fanboy in Big Hero 6, and Jonathan, the hysterical slacker dude nephew, in the Hotel Transylvania movies, and they kind of out Shaggy. And then for some reason they have Scooby-Doo talking, not just mangling an occasional word, you know, yoikes, but he's giving whole lines of dialogue, and it just doesn't work. And I don't understand why he's doing it.
It sounds like it's potentially selling out the series.
Yeah, which was itself not that great a piece of artistry to begin with, although this is full of little Easter eggs about the original series. Like, they go to the Takamoto Bowling Alley, which is a little tip of the hat to Iwo Takamoto, who designed the characters. Or they refer to Slag Hoople at some point, which is Wilma Flintstone's maiden name. So it's a lot of Hanna-Barbera in-jokes, but not much. And, you know, I went to college and got 3 degrees so I could recognize Wilma Flintstone's maiden name.
I love it. So, Christy, what'd you think of Scoob?
It is a very weird combination of stuff, because it takes place in the present day, but then it has that groovy flower power vibe. You know, Fred still drives a mystery machine and they all wear the same kind of clothes, but it takes place now. In the beginning, when it is the origin story of how Scooby and Shaggy meet and how the five of them get together and they create Mystery Incorporated, when they're little kids, it's actually really sweet. The moment that Scooby and Shaggy meet on the beach in the very beginning is really charming and kind of heartwarming, because they're both kind of lonely and scared and they find each other, and it's really lovely. and how, you know, the cuteness of them meeting and promising one another, okay, we're never going to go inside of a dark, creepy house again, right? I mean, there's some funny stuff in the beginning. And then it becomes this massive and convoluted story, as Charles said, about stopping Cerberus from coming out of the underworld. And they're also trying to cram in all kinds of pop culture references. There's a really weird through line involving one particular celebrity cameo that's strange and very strained. And like the, you know, the music, it's like Outkast, Bombs Over Baghdad. It's a weird mishmash of trying to appeal to adults and kids at the same time. My 10-year-old son is a pretty big Scooby-Doo fan. He's played the Scooby-Doo video game even that is shaped like the joystick is shaped like the van. And he turned to me like halfway through this movie and he goes, honestly, I liked it better when they were kids. Because once they're teenagers, it just gets frantic and noisy. And some of the laziest writing toward the end, how they get out of the jam that they're in, is so lazy and so quick and easy. It was head spinning. So yeah, this is not good.
We're talking about the animated film Scoob with Scooby-Doo. Wade?
I concur 100% with everything that Christy and Charles have already said. I like the prologue with them as kids. I really like the credit sequence, which is basically a 3D animated, CGI animated replica of what was the credit sequence, the title sequence of the original cartoon. So that was fun to see them parrot that. And then it just goes straight downhill. The problem here, I think, is that there's this obsession with intellectual property, IP. Everything has to be based on IP. And I think Warner Media in the AT&T era looks at this library of Hanna-Barbera content and says, how can we explode this into our own Hanna-Barbera universe? How can we make this into a kind of a mini Marvel universe? And so you get Blue Falcon and Dynamite and Dick Dastardly and Muttley, and they're really shoehorning everything into this to try to jumpstart a new explosion of Hanna-Barbera-themed stuff. And I don't think it's going to work because, as has been noted, it's a Gen X phenomenon, and they're trying to take that Gen X phenomenon and repackage it for Gen Y and, you know, the going forward. And it just isn't going to work because it doesn't have the same resonance.
We're talking about Scoob, the animated film directed by Tony Cervini. The film is available on just about every on-demand platform you can imagine. It's rated PG. Capone gives us the last year of Al Capone's life. Tom Hardy stars as the gangster. Linda Cardellini and Jack Lowden co-star. Josh Trank is the writer-director. Christy.
Oh my goodness, is this just a baffling misfire? This is just terrible, but exquisitely so, and it must be seen. I don't really know what Tom Hardy is doing here. You know, I mean, he's one of the greatest actors working today, and he is very well known for digging deep and creating these emotionally and physically transformative performances. And he does that here, but the choices he makes, particularly with the voice he's doing, are really distracting and quite often unintentionally hilarious. This follows the last year of Al Capone's life as he is rattling around his mansion in Florida and suffering from dementia. And you don't know what is imaginary, what is a memory, what is a dream, what actually happened that he's just remembering differently. And it feels like a slog. And I appreciate that Josh Trank is trying to get into his mind and show in a respectful way what dementia can do, what can happen to the mind, the deterioration that's going on. But it's also crammed full of poop jokes with really noisy sound design. And the sight of Tom Hardy shuffling around this tacky Florida estate with a gun in diapers pooping all over himself is just bizarre. Linda Cardellini as his wife is doing some lovely work, but it's like she's in a totally different film. I mean, she's acting opposite this Tasmanian devil whirlwind of a performance. She's just trying to bring emotional groundedness to it, and that's really hard. Having said that, it's got to be seen. It's just so strange.
Capone, Wade.
It is so watchably unwatchable. It is magnificent. Everything that Christy said and more. You know, these come around every so often, and it's really true. When great actors make bad movies, they give the best terrible performances. Tom Hardy is such a good actor that when you stick him in a part that's this bad, this badly written, and a movie that's this bad, he just takes it to the nth degree. And I couldn't help but think that Al Pacino was watching this in awe, just thinking, even my worst performance has never been this good. It is really, truly a spectacular train wreck to behold. I'm going to say it's almost Cats level astonishing. it really does need to be seen to be believed.
And in terms of her performance, are we like Faye Dunaway in Mommy Dearest? Or?
Yes, exactly. Okay. It's right in that ballpark, right in that pocket.
Great actor with a performance that is one of their most memorable, not in an intentional way. Capone is on multiple video on demand platforms, Lemley's Virtual Cinema as well. It's rated R. Mother's Little Helpers, a comedic drama starring Melanie Hutsell and Kestrin Pantera. Pantera is also the writer-director of the film. Wade?
Really solid little indie. The premise is something that's fairly familiar. Bring a bunch of estranged siblings back to the foot of a dying parent's bed and sort of let all of the family dynamics play out, all of the issues that have been simmering. Usually it's a dying father that this is all centered around. In this case, it's a dying mother who has a bit of a flower child background as well, and who carries a lot of the blame to bear for all of the issues that are floating around between the siblings, but they all come back together. And what I liked about this was that despite the fact that we've seen this premise so much, and I've seen it in like probably three or four different languages over the past 2 years, but what they do a very good job of giving you characters that are fresh. So even if the scenario is familiar, the characters are fresh, the relationships and the issues between them are fresh, and the acting is really, really good. And everything that they try to sell you on is very, very credible, and it winds up being incredibly engaging and honest, and you start to feel as if you know this family and you know exactly where they came from. And even at that point, you have no idea where it's going. It takes some really interesting twists and turns.
Christy, we're talking about Mother's Little Helpers.
I like this very much too. And as Wade said, this is a very familiar kind of genre, but it has surprises over and over again. There is a real emotional authenticity going on here. And Kestrin Pantera came up with a story based on some experiences in her own life. And all of the other actors playing the siblings contributed to the script. And so each character feels very well defined and very distinct. It's not like it's just the one main sibling and everyone's kind of a blob of angst. Like each actor or actress really gets a moment to shine and to show some complexity to their roles. I like Melanie Hutsell. She's not quite old enough to be playing the mother of all of these other people. And that's a little distracting the whole way through. But I like the way this is shot. There's sort of a gauzy, nostalgic look to some of the flashbacks from when the siblings were children that gives it a vivid sense of place and of the 70s kind of throwback that they're aiming for here. So yeah, it's a really nice little indie.
Mother's Little Helpers is unrated. You can see it on multiple video on demand platforms like Amazon Prime Video, Google Play, and YouTube. The documentary, The Ballad of Ezequiel Hernandez, is narrated by Tommy Lee Jones. Kieran Fitzgerald, the director. Wade?
This is quite good. This was originally on television in 2008, hasn't been on VOD before. It's a story in 1997 of a really tragic killing of this high school student down near the U.S.-Mexico border, Ezequiel Hernandez, who was just out shooting his .22 and was apparently completely unaware of the fact that the bushes and the shrubs that he was shooting near were camouflaged U.S. Marines who had been deployed there to fight drug trafficking on the border. And it's a very, very porous border. You know, there are border towns on either side, so it's an area where the border has sort of has a history of being very loose. And the events surrounding this and what happened to the Marines thereafter is really an unbelievable tragedy. You get it from all sides. The Marines themselves are interviewed. The family of Ezequiel Hernandez is interviewed. A historian from his town is interviewed. So you get a very complete picture. No voice is left out. It takes a slight propaganda drip at the end, which I thought was unfortunate, but it doesn't necessarily undermine or invalidate the rest of the film. It's a really superbly made documentary and a story that rips at your heart.
The Ballad of Ezequiel Hernandez is available on iTunes Video On Demand and Amazon Prime Video, unrated, as Wade mentioned. Premiered on television 12 years ago, but it's first time available on Video On Demand. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC and the KPECC app. We also remind you, anytime you want to listen to Film Week, you can tell your smart speaker to play KPECC. Film Week available as a podcast also wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And our Film Week critics also have put together curated lists of their personal favorite films and TV shows available for binge watching for streaming online. You can find the recommendations at LAist.com. I sure hope you're having a terrific day. We're talking about what's available to stream or to watch on demand in your own home. A little bit later, we've got some critics' picks for you. And we also are going to talk about what's going on in the production front with film and television programs. I'm joined this week by critics Charles Solomon, Christy Lemire, and Wade Major. Next is the Canadian drama Castle in the Ground. It's written and directed by Joey Klein, stars Alex Wolff, Imogene Poots, and Tom Cullen. Christy?
I liked this. It is unrelentingly bleak, but it's very well acted. Alex Wolff stars as a 19-year-old who is caring for his terminally ill mother, played by Neve Campbell. Once she dies, and this happens early on, he becomes friends with the woman who lives across the hall from him in their kind of rundown working class apartment building, played by Imogen Poots. And she is an opioid addict. And in his grief and in his desire to escape and just be in denial of, you know, his entire life being upended, he becomes friends with her and gets sucked into her world. And the movie does not glamorize drug use, but it makes it really vivid and really understandable as to the allure of this young woman. She is very smart and she's exciting and dangerous. And she also kind of provides a strong female figure in his life when the one that he's had for so long is now gone. And it's how he, you know, gets sucked into her world and her troubles, and it gets increasingly dark. It's surprisingly emotional sometimes too, and it's very well acted, but it's not for everyone because it's got kind of a one-note tone there of just despair and anxiety.
We're talking about the drama Castle in the Ground. The film is unrated, and it's available on several on-demand platforms. The action thriller Blood and Money stars Tom Berenger, Kristen Hager, and Paul Benvictor. John Barr makes his feature writing and directing debut with Blood and Money. Wade.
Yeah, this is one of those wilderness noirs. It's a pretty decent thriller, and it's a nice little showy part, late career showy part for Tom Berenger. Takes place in the wild, wooded northern part of Maine, which is kind of a lawless frontier of sorts. And Tom Berenger plays a veteran who's has a bit of a broken life. He, you know, lives in a camper, and we don't really quite know what scarred him or how he got where he is. But he's going out and he's buck hunting, and in the process of buck hunting, he winds up coming face to face with a group of bank robbers, violent, murderous bank robbers, who are trying to make their way to Canada through this wilderness. And it becomes a one man against the bad guys thing, a little bit of a High Noon scenario, few other genre films that it borrows from. But on balance, it's very competently made, and the fact that Barringer is playing an older guy, a vet who's not, you know, he's not Arnold Schwarzenegger, he's not even Liam Neeson. He's a guy who really has to struggle every step of the way to make any kind of gains on these guys. So it has a gritty credibility to it that makes it better than the average film in this genre, I would say.
We're talking about Blood and Money, starring Tom Barringer. The film's unrated. You can see it on iTunes, Apple TV, and Fandango now. The documentary Up From the Streets gives us a look at New Orleans through its music. Michael Murphy, the director, Charles.
Well, I think this is about the third documentary on New Orleans and jazz we've had in recent years, and in many ways, I think it's the best. It's much more thorough and much more careful in its explanations. For instance, any number of films will tell you, oh, there are, you know, African and Cuban influences on jazz. Here they have someone talk about, okay, in New Orleans, you have this three-part rhythm that's counted this way. In Cuba, it's counted slightly differently, but it's still the same time. And then they explain that the French and Spanish brought slaves from different parts of Africa to New Orleans, where they brought their own traditions of percussion and drumming. And so this thoroughness really gives you a grounding and helps you understand how it's being built. And they have an extraordinary number of interviews with everyone from Wynton and Branford Marsalis to Harry Connick Jr. and Keith Richards and Sting, all talking about how this music has influenced them. It's very upbeat, very interesting, and I learned a lot from it. Jazz is not a genre I know or a music form I know particularly well, but I found this very interesting and very entertaining, if a little bit long.
Sounds good. Up From the Streets, music documentaries unrated. Michael Murphy, the director, and it's available to see on Lemley's virtual cinema platform. The sci-fi drama Proximity stars Ryan Masson and Heidi Kwan. It's directed by Eric Demusi, who is also the co-screenwriter. Wade.
Yeah, Eric Demusi is a former visual effects guy. This is his writing and directing debut. And as silly and ridiculous as this is, if you're in the mood for a good old-fashioned flying saucer alien abduction movie, this will definitely scratch the itch. But bear in mind, those movies have never been good. They're not supposed to be good. The silliness and the outlandishness of them is the whole point. This takes itself a little too seriously at times, but it's basically about a JPL scientist who is witness to what looks like a crashed flying saucer and winds up being abducted by it, blacks out, doesn't have any recollection of it, but he has what seem to be powers in the wake of it. And next thing you know, government agents are chasing him and he's trying to track down the aliens and connect with other people who may have been abducted. And it makes absolutely no sense, but it's riveting at the same time. You just, once it starts, you can't take your eyes off of it. It's a pretty solid, straightforward chase scenario. And as much as you tell yourself that it's dumb and there's no reason to watch it, it keeps its grip on you very effectively.
Proximity, the sci-fi drama, is unrated. It's available on multiple on-demand platforms. Body Cam, a drama starring Mary J. Blige and Nat Wolff. The film directed by Malik Vital. It's rated R. Christy.
Yes, earlier we talked about Alex Wolff in Castle on the Ground. Here is his older brother, Nat. So this is kind of a strange and ambitious genre mashup here. It's a Black Lives Matter horror movie, and a very gory one at that, but also a surprisingly well-acted one, and a lot of that has to do with Mary J. Blige just showing up and being Mary J. Blige, and she's just always awesome and has this tremendous presence about her. She plays a police officer who is recently back from taking a leave for something we learn about eventually as the film goes on. And there's a horrific encounter that a fellow officer has that shows up on his body cam that only she can see. For some reason, everybody else looks at this video and it seems to have been scratched somehow or erased or glitched, but she sees it and she sees what really happens. And then over and over again, cops are getting targeted and she's the only one who can see the supernatural force that is causing these horrific attacks against the police department. And it is moody and suspenseful and kind of strange and really, really gory. So if you're not good with extreme blood and gore, you're going to have a problem here, especially with teeth. If you have a problem with teeth, you might have difficulty watching this. But I was surprised at how much I liked it and how much I admired the ambition of it.
Wait, what'd you think of body cam?
Yeah, this is these are the fruits of the next generation after Jordan Peele. You know, Jordan Peele did something with Get Out that really kind of lit a fuse, which is he said, you can take social issues and horror, and you can put the two together in a very artful way. Now, George Romero did it, but he didn't do it terribly artfully. Jordan Peele said you can make artistic, A-quality horror films that have a real social commentary to them. And that's exactly what this is doing. It's taking that cue, and it is it's spinning a story that is fairly simple, but in an incredibly tense way. The suspense here is so thick you could cut it with a knife. And I've got to say, Mary J. Blige has created a whole new acting career for herself that is just awesome. We all knew for years she was an amazing singer, and then she started acting, and we said, wow, that's a great performance, and that's another great performance. With this, which is 180 degrees away from everything she's done before, I think she can do anything. She may be even better as an actress than she is as a singer.
Well, and this reminds you of how so often singers, because of the interpreted skill that they have to bring to a song, how that can be transferable to acting in film and television. Body Cam, starring Mary J. Blige, Malik Vital, the director, Raymond Reddell, and Nicholas McCarthy, the co-screenwriters, rated R on multiple on-demand platforms. The Japanese film Samurai Marathons, directed by Bernard Rose. Wade?
Yeah, no, it's kind of weird. Bernard Rose, who's best known here for things like Candyman and Immortal Beloved, went to Japan and adapted a 2014 book about an event in 1858, I think it is, where a feudal lord in Japan had a foot race, a 36-mile foot race between the samurai to prepare them to fight Commodore Perry's purported invasion, or what he feared was an invasion. And of course, into this you fold all the, you know, whoever wins is going to get a whatever they dream of, whatever their wish is. So you get a very colorful collection of samurai running this race, who all have different things they want out of it, including the feudal lord's own daughter, who goes a little bit yentl to try to be able to flee the power of her father. And then you wrap this up in a lot of political intrigue inside of Japan between this feudal lord and the shogun. It's a little bit convoluted for the first half. It spends too much time kind of treading water on all the various narrative details for about 45, 50 minutes. Then the foot race starts, and then the swords come out, and the samurai do more samurai than marathon. So it's uneven, but it ultimately sticks its landing and ends on a very strong note.
Samurai Marathon, directed by Bernard Rose. It's unrated on multiple demand platforms. The Netflix romantic comedy The Wrong Missy stars David Spade, Lauren Lapkus, and Nick Swarsden. Tyler Spindell is the director, Chris Pappas and Kevin Barnett, the screenwriters. Wade?
I was in shocked that I wound up really liking this as much as I did. It's a pretty straightforward Adam Sandler-produced movie without Adam Sandler. David Spade is a guy who goes on a really bad blind date, and then after that meets the girl of his dreams. They're both named Missy, and when he goes on a corporate retreat, he invites the wrong Missy. It's the crazy one, not the one that he thought he was all smitten by. And the crazy one, you know, risks wrecking the entire retreat and his potential raise. You know where this goes. We've seen this a million times. It's been a Jim Carrey movie. It's been an Adam Sandler movie. It's been a Will Ferrell movie. But the fact that it's a woman who's completely out of her mind this time, that's nice. Lauren Lapkus is hilarious. David Spade is still David Spade. And even though I didn't laugh a lot, there is one slapstick bit that absolutely sent me over the edge, and I nearly lost motor control and consciousness at the same time.
The Wrong Missy. Christy?
I can't say that it had that kind of bodily effect on me. But yeah, I was vaguely amused here and there. This is every bit an Adam Sandler movie. All his buddies are there. It's the usual thing where they go on vacation and they pretend that they're making a movie in the process, and this is the result of it. So they're in Hawaii, this luxurious hotel. It is silly, it is gross, it is slapsticky, and then as all these movies tend to do, it makes this very abrupt 180 and wants us to feel things. Aw, we should feel things that are nice and warm and sweet now after all of the gross out jokes. And it's always, you know, head spinning how quickly they want us to make that shift. But, you know, if you're going to watch this kind of movie, you're going to watch this kind of movie.
The Wrong Missy, starring David Spade. It's unrated, streaming on Netflix. Want to take a moment to remember Jerry Stiller, who was so stellar on television comedies like Seinfeld, probably his best known role as Frank Costanza, George's disgruntled father. Here Frank explains how he made up the holiday Festivus.
Many Christmases ago, I went to buy a doll for my son. I reached for the last one they had. But so did another man. As I rained blows upon him, I realized there had to be another way.
What happened to the doll?
It was destroyed. But out of that, a new holiday was born. A Festivus for the rest of us.
That must have been some kind of doll.
She was. And at the Festivus dinner, you gather your family around and tell them all the ways they have disappointed you over the past year.
And is there a tree?
No, instead there's a pole. Requires no decoration. I find tinsel distracting.
Jerry Stiller, father of actor Ben Stiller, of course, and so many memorable television and film roles, and with his wife Ann Mira, who predeceased him, just legendary performances on the old Ed Sullivan Show. He died, Jerry Stiller did, earlier this week of natural causes at the age of 92. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Don't go anywhere. We have much more to come in just 90 seconds. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with Christy Lemire, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. They're each going to give a pick or two for things that aren't brand new necessarily, but well worth your home viewing time. And let's actually start with Wade. You've got a couple of films in honor of the late Max von Sydow. What are the two films you think are really worth seeing from his prime?
These are both on Film Movement Plus, which is a wonderful service, and the films both won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival for director Billy August, one of the few who has won the Palme d'Or twice. The first is Pella the Conqueror. The second is The Best Intentions. Pella the Conqueror, Max von Sydow plays they're both period films. He plays a father and of a young son, and they're peasants, and they're trying to make their way in the household of a wealthier family. And it's just a beautiful study of parenthood and class and a particular period in Swedish history. The Best Intentions, which won the Palme d'Or in 1992, is an extraordinary masterpiece written by Ingmar Bergman about the courtship, the tumultuous and very fractious courtship of his parents. And Max von Sydow plays his maternal grandfather in that one. They are both absolutely wonderful films, and you should at least get a trial subscription to Film Movement Plus just to see these two.
All right, Wade, thanks very much. Christy, you have what might be an unconventional recommendation for a film critic.
Well, we contain multitudes, Larry, and I have many interests.
Many facets to Christy Lemire.
Yes, one of which is baseball. We are huge baseball fans in this house.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, as so many people in L.A. are sad to be, you know, unable to watch the Dodgers, you can watch Korean baseball. The KBO is playing in South Korea in empty stadiums, although they have kind of like cardboard cutouts behind home plate in some of the ballparks. But ESPN is broadcasting all of these Korean baseball organization games. They're on kind of in the middle of the night, though. They're on like 2 a.m., 1 a.m., 2 a.m. our time. ESPN does do rebroadcasts, but it's kind of fun to follow along and see, you know, which team might seem tantamount to the one that you like. They all have really cool mascots, really cute, funny mascots. Korean players are known for their very artful bat flips. You know, so while it may seem disrespectful elsewhere, like it's really cool and awesome to flip your bat in the air when you hit a home run. So it's a lot of fun. If you miss baseball, it can be found. The KBO.
Sounds good. The KBO Korean Baseball League. Plus, you'll get a taste of what it's like to watch games on TV with no fans in the stands. Christy, you also wanted to mention quickly that the cinematographer Roger Deakins has a new podcast.
My great hero, the legendary Roger Deakins, who has shot so many Coen Brothers films. He has two Oscars now. He's got a podcast with his wife, and it's called the Team Deakins Podcast. And they began kind of broadly with getting your start in the industry, but more recent episodes have focused on very specific aspects of filmmaking, like lens choice, like lighting. And it's this really fascinating free film school. As genius and as accomplished as he is, he's an incredibly humble and generous man. And it's a lot to learn. So the Team Deakins Podcast.
All right, wherever you get your podcasts. And Charles, you've got a couple of films that Funimation is making available?
Yeah, although I so loved the cinematography in 1917, I'm going to watch that podcast, listen to that
sound
podcast
good?
Now.
Yeah.
Funimation is doing something through the virtual reality platform Big Screen, a series of features. Friday night, they're doing Katsuhiro Otomo's Akira, which is, of course, one of the watershed films, not only in the history of animation, but of filmmaking. And with My Neighbor Totoro, it really created the mass audience for anime in America. It's dark, it's violent, it's oblique, it's fascinating. It's completely unlike the upbeat fantasies that we get from American animation studios. And also available through this is Makoto Shinkai's Your Name. That's the number one box office hit in Japanese animation history. We've talked about it before. It's an extraordinary film that begins as a body-swapping teen rom-com, but then as it develops, it becomes a meditation on the trauma that Japanese people continue to experience from the disaster that we call Fukushima in 2011, and that they refer to as the Great East Japan Disaster or Catastrophe. It's just such an exceptional film.
And those are on Funimation's own platform, Charles?
Through something called Big Screen that I wasn't familiar with, but I'm sure the Funimation channel would have the information on it too.
All right. And we remind you that a number of curated personal lists of favorite movies, television programs, even as you heard from Christy, a podcast, can be found at laist.com. You can see the recommendations from our critics there. We'll continue taking a look at the latest on the state of television and film production in just a moment. Next up on Film Week, we turn our attention to the dramatic changes in both the film and television industries in this era of COVID-19 and some very significant developments. Joining us to talk about them, the host of KPCC's The Frame, John Horn, and senior editor at Deadline, which covers the business of Hollywood, Dominic Patton. Dominic and John, great to have you both with us. Let's start with Scoob, the animated film releasing this week. Our critics just reviewed it earlier this hour, Warner Brothers putting it out on video on demand. Universal, similarly, a few weeks ago, did that with Trolls World 2, and Disney this week announcing that Hamilton, the theatrical version of the stage production, is also going to go out digitally on Disney Plus. John, is this indicative of where studios are going to go long term, even post COVID-19?
Not if the theater owners can help it, but yes, necessity being the mother of invention, these are movies that I think audiences are eager to see, and there's no way to release them right now. And even if there's a handful of theaters open in certain states, some people have talked about drive-ins, there's no way it makes financial sense to release a movie nationally if you can't be in every city in the country. So the workaround that Universal and Warner and Disney are trying are taking these movies either straight to video on demand or to their streaming platforms. The theater owners don't really have any bargaining position. They have said they're not going to show any Universal movies going forward. Now, if you are a movie theater owner or maybe you're a stockholder in that company and they say they're not going to show the next Fast and the Furious movie, I think you got to say maybe that's penny wise, pound foolish. So, yes, I think this is an opportunity the studios have been looking for a long time, and they're going to seize it, and maybe they're not going to turn back.
Dominic, I would think that how Scoob performs is going to be big because Trolls World Tour was such an on-demand sensation. If Scoob performs similarly, wouldn't that have a big impact?
I think that there's a new reality emerging here week by week, and you see it with Trolls, and now you're going to see it with Scoob, and you're going to see how this is going to be determined on the bottom line. I think that we are not at a tipping point of same-day releases once the world gets back to normal somewhat. Theater releases are always going to have a life, but I think we're at a new evaluation point. And I think that new evaluation point is there are some movies that are just going to work differently going forward because there is an audience there, and the audience is willing to pay, and the audience want to pay to watch at home. And the studios are now going to say so to the theater owners. So now that everyone's back in the theaters, you want us to give up that money as well? I think so, especially with all of the hits they've taken during this crisis. They're going to want every penny they can get.
And John, just quickly with Hamilton, I realize it's not a movie. It's a filmed stage presentation of Hamilton. But why do you think they decided to put it on Disney Plus instead of hold it for theaters?
I think they need content. I mean, listen, with production shut down by the end of the fall, probably everybody's going to run out of new stuff. And if you are trying to launch a service like Disney Plus, and you know, come October, November, you're not going to have a lot of new content, why not put something you're sitting on until next year for a theatrical release? And who knows what the theatrical business is going to look like even a year from now. You've got something with a brand, go ahead and put it out now.
All right. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Larry Mantle with Deadline senior editor Dominic Patton and KPECC's The Frame host John Horn. Coming up, we'll take a look at what's happening to the broadcast and cable networks as they, too, are running short of content as well as advertisers. It's Film Week on KPECC. So good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined right now by John Horn of KPECC's The Frame and Dominic Patton, senior editor at Deadline. Television networks are facing a particular challenge, and that is to come up with fresh programming as they go into the summer and then later the fall. Because of COVID-19, production has been suspended. With some of the live programming, they're trying to have the shows produced at home, but that, of course, has its own challenges. Let's talk about some of the ways they're filling the programming. Dominic, can you give us some examples of where they're turning?
Well, I mean, as you said, Larry, they're turning to at home. Saturday Night Live just wrapped up its 45th season with its third at home edition of this season. This weekend, we're going to see former President Obama do a virtual high school graduation that's going to be shown on all the networks. We've seen these benefits like the One World concert and the Elton John one that was on Fox early on this. They're looking for a ton of program. And of course, because, you know, they have such a market dominance, let's just talk about them. Disney has had their second Disney Family sing-along special, which have been incredibly highly rated. And they're getting better at this. You know, what we first saw, which kind of looked like it was kind of the little Abner gang throwing together a show, is actually becoming quite sophisticated on many levels. You have to remember, a lot of cable news is being done like this, too, with remote studios and green screens in people's apartments now turning into high-tech backdrops. So the content is there. But as we were discussing with Hamilton beforehand, you know, like the content, there's only so much content in that pipeline. And people are trying to find new ideas. Now, there are some people who are coming up with social distancing shows, like the creator of Orange is the New Black. The CBS series All Rise, which is about an L.A. Superior Court judge, actually had as its season finale a couple weeks ago. They actually had a show that was done as if it was taking place in this reality. So it was all done by Zoom and those type of web event cameras as people were talking to each other, and a bench trial occurred. People are trying to be innovative. The problem is, as the All Rise season finale shows, you can do that once and make it look like you're being timely and clever. Over time, people, I think, are getting zoomed out. So finding content here is now grabbing content from other places.
And John, one of the things that I was seeing is that some of those musical talent cultivation shows that have now, you know, switched to doing their auditioning process and their performances at home are seeing a drop off in viewership. It doesn't seem to have the same appeal, at least initially, as the grand, you know, studio set productions.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see that carried forward with sports. I mean, the Bundesliga soccer is supposed to return this weekend in Germany with no spectators. Premier League might do the same. Who knows what college football is going to be like? But I think you really touched on something, and that is even if you're watching at home, you want to be part of the crowd. You want to be part of the audience. You want to feel like you are watching with everybody else. And if you're doing something that is not live, even though it's supposed to be live, like a competition show, it feels fake. And I think that's a real problem. I think it's going to be a real problem for sports. As much as people want to see sports, will it feel the same if there's no fans, if you're playing at neutral stadiums? I think that takes away such an integral element of what it means to be a spectator, even when you're watching at home. And it's true for reality shows, and it's true for sports as well.
Dominic, you were talking about other places that cable and broadcast networks are turning. I saw they're looking to programs that have been streaming as one of the sources.
Well, yeah, I mean, and some of these are pretty natural fits. You know, the CW, which had its equivalent of what would have been the upfronts this recently. And let's be honest, this is when we all would have been, or at least I would, and maybe John, would have been like munching on, you know, expensive lobster from CBS and drinking, you know, fine wine provided by NBC Comcast at their big advertiser presentations in New York. None of that's happening. It's all virtual. But to that end, the CW, for instance, grabbed Stargirl, which is a series that they're going to debut this weekend, which is also being shown on the DC Universe streaming system, as well as they've grabbed Swamp Thing, a show based on the comic book that they was on DC Universe and is now wrapped up. They're going to have at least a season of that. So those are happening. Spectrum, if you're a Spectrum subscriber, have their own network, and they've had shows like LA's Finest, the cop show. That cop show is now going to show up on Fox. There's been two seasons of it. So people are finding things that haven't had so many eyeballs and bringing them to the bigger version of the small screen in the hopes of filling these schedules, because the fall has to have programming. That's where the rubber will hit the road for the networks and the studios, if they have blank spots, or as John just detailed, shows that just simply are not cutting it with an audience.
John, Dominic, just talking about the upfronts, and one of the things we're hearing is that advertisers who had previously made longer-term commitments are now looking at withdrawing. What sort of financial exposure are the broadcast networks and cable networks looking at?
About $40 billion.
Whoa.
TV market in any year, and a lot of that is sold in advance. And Dominic was talking about the upfronts, where a lot of the advertising commitments are made. So the problem is, the ratings themselves haven't been catastrophic because people are at home, but there are other issues. People aren't working. We have unemployment headed to 20%. So if you're selling a car, nobody's really buying a car. If you're selling trips, I mean, think about the things that you see on normal TV advertisements. Those things are not selling. So the advertisers have an option to get out, and that's going to kind of create a spiraling effect in terms of where money's going to come for program acquisition or program production. And I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, it's not as if anybody is really having a lot of money to spend anywhere. I mean, media buying has declined in newspapers. It's declined on the radio. It's declined in magazines. And so what's happening in television is just on a much bigger scale. Although I have an idea.
Yeah.
It's a crazy idea where the networks can find new content that's never been seen before. How about if they take all of those episodes on Quibi that nobody's watching and stitch them together, then they have a full-length show that nobody's seen.
Quibi, the little mini videos, exactly, mini programs. Dominic, I wonder about cord cutting as well, because you would think with high unemployment, people being financially strapped, there might be more people who cut cable or satellite. But at the same time, if they're home all the time, maybe that's one of the later things they cut.
Well, but I think we're seeing that happening already. The numbers are going down. You're seeing it because the fact is there is a trade-off you have to make, isn't there, Larry? Is we're now so many weeks into this that people have gotten past maybe some severance or a couple of weeks they got. They might have gotten their government stimulus check, but, you know, $1,200 is only going to go so far once you pay the rent and buy food. The $120, $140 that people pay for their cable and what have you, they're going to go online if they've got a Netflix subscription, if they've got an Amazon Prime, and, you know, those sort of places. We are seeing a lot of advertisers actually also going online. They're going to Facebook, where they're finding their captive audience. And like John said, where you're not looking for hoping out of the 4 million who are watching, 5,000 of them can afford to buy a new Mercedes-Benz. But what's going to be interesting, I think, that's coming out of this, as now as the advertisers are able to free up their commitment, the networks are also looking to them to free up. So I think nobody's going to go dry, so to speak. I think that what we're hearing at Deadline is there's a lot of backroom talk happening. There's negotiation. There is old-fashioned bartering. And this isn't really new for the networks. NBC, for instance, has done this for years where they have said, look, buy some ads for the Olympics and or buy some ads for the Super Bowl, and we'll throw you in some Olympic ads as well.
All right. So there are going to be a lot of wheeling and dealing. Dominic, thank you so much. Senior editor at Deadline, John Horn, host of KPECC's The Frame, giving us the latest update on what's going on in the film and television business in the era of COVID-19. From all of us, have a terrific weekend. Thanks so much for joining us for Film Week on KPECC.